Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and it's a very unusual show in that we have three guests. This season witnesses an incredible flowering in the field of comic books. They've become comic book novels, and I have the writer-artists of two of the most extraordinary of this, not exactly new genre, but I guess new to the appearance to the public via publication by Pantheon novels. Those are Chris Ware, the author of Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth, and Daniel Clowes, the author of David Boring. The books both come from Pantheon, and with them is the designer, co-editor of both books, Chip Kidd, who is well-known as an award-winning graphic artist who has altered the way books, particularly books from Alfred A. Knopf, are looking nowadays. I wanted to begin. Can you fill me in on how it came to be that we now have graphic novels of this length and integrity and complexity? What's the history here? Daniel Clowes?
I guess for me, the first thing I would think of in the world of graphic novels would be Art Spiegelman's Mouse, which what the first volume of that came out in, what, the mid-'80s, early 80s. And that was one of, you know, as a young student of the form, that was one of the first things I saw that intended to sort of go beyond the issue-to-issue narrative that we read in, you know, Donald Duck comics as kids. And sort of pointed a direction that we could have this whole world ahead of us of doing books or stories that are, you know, equivalent to novels or large movies and as large as we wanted. And it was merely the economics of the situation that sort of prevented us from doing that until Random House stepped in.
And which were your, Chris, which were your favorites of the things that preceded you? I know, for instance, that you edited a beautiful subsection of a issue of Drawn and Quarterly, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
In which you have the Gasoline Alley artist and you have done the cover that is a clear indication of his influence on you. But what were the kinds of things that stylistically that you wanted to import into this graphic novels?
Well, as far as, I mean, the graphic novels starting out, I guess, go, when I was about 19 or so in college, I remember reading Art Spiegelman's Mouse in chapter installations, I guess, and being really inspired by the fact that he obviously had a clear vision and scope and mind of it. And I was so inspired by that on my own terms that at that time I thought, like, I will do one too.
One of the things I like about these two books by my guests, Chris Ware and Daniel Clowes, is that each of the books seems to look like the work of these authors. That is to say, the cover of the Ware book is in pale pinks and muted grays. It watches a city reach its sunset and then explode into flames. On one side of the cover, you see, there is something origami-like. That is to say, there are insides to the Jimmy Corrigan world. And this cover comes off the book and opens up, getting larger and larger, two-sided. It shows you both Jimmy, who can be built out of small parts. He has something of a Charlie Brown head, and he has, the very careful builder can build a miniature Jimmy Corrigan. perhaps with the aid of an enlarging Xerox. The other side is the world. The self and the world is in many ways the subject of this book, as is folding to hide, retiring nature. The author's name has to be searched for on the cover of the book. The David Boring book, on the other hand, by Daniel Clowes, is in your face. It has brighter colors, although they are nocturnal. It screams at you the way a movie ad would. And I wanted to ask you, Chip Kidd, about designing books so that they reflect the author's personalities and the personality of their work.
Well, here I would have to speak up and say that even though I was technically the editor on both of these projects and all that that entails, in terms of design, both of these were completely designed by the authors. There are some projects that we, graphic novel, comic book stuff that we do at Pantheon that I do have a hand in the way it looks. But in terms of both of these, I just pretty much had to steer them through the publishing process. As you've astutely pointed out, I think one of the best compliments I've heard from the Jimmy Corrigan book so far from a designer was they were very impressed because it broke every single rule of what makes a functioning book jacket, except the best rule, which I think is that it makes you want to pick it up and it makes you want to open it and find out what it's about.
The David Boring book, when I say that it looks like a film poster, its structural metaphor, more or less, is that although it's a cartoon strip, it's a movie. David Boring is a would-be filmmaker, and the frames of the cartoon strip are not only frames of a cartoon strip, they're frames of a film. They are, second generation in a sense, because David Boring's father was a comic strip drawer, and he has done these extraordinary strips that have been destroyed by David's mother, divorced from the father, and now hates him. And so the rare copies of the strip that exist can only be found in individual frames for reasons that the book makes clear. And these, in turn, are built into a kind of ongoing movie. But it's a very odd kind of movie, and I wondered if you could describe its, structural displacements, if you would.
Well, the whole thing comes from, at the time I was working on this book, I was also working on a film. I was working on a film project, and I had written a screenplay, and I had met with a lot of problems with this, and I was sort of struggling with both the sort of business aspects of trying to get a film, the kind of film I wanted to get made, which was a difficult struggle, and also with just the formal aspects, the difference between writing something for film and writing something for comics. And it was just a constant overriding thought in my thought process as I was working on this. And as I started this book, I knew it would have something to do with that, but I had no idea how it would emerge as such a dominant theme in the story. And it became all about the different ways of putting pictures together in sequence and the ways that we can interpret those things. And I like the idea that all this kid had to remember his father by were, 15 drawings that he did that he could put together in any sequence to tell a story. And he was just struggling with those 15 images to try to tell the right story that had some kind of a resolution that would be satisfying in a narrative sequence.
I'm speaking with Chris Ware, author of Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth, and Daniel Clowes, author of David Boring, both from Pantheon, and also with Chip Kidd, their co-editor. I want listeners to know that the reason why these two books are being featured on Bookworm is because I find in them the techniques and strategies that I find in my favorite and what I hope is the best literature. That is to say, for instance, in David Boring, there are dream sequences that are not delineated as such. There are sudden flash forwards in the plot. The reader has to do a lot to imagine this world and why it's being interrupted by so many kinds of subjectivities and interpenetrations of image. The cover itself represents three or four orders of reality simultaneously. And my pleasure is in feeling that these books belong to the world of the postmodern literature of the avant-garde. These books seem to me to be raised in protest against what the world subsequent to the first underground comics has systematically become. These books want to be a different kind of consciousness, it seems to me.
I think Chris and I are both the sorts of people who are sort of dissatisfied with the modern world, and I think there's a certain type you find who's drawn to cartooning who tends to have that kind of nostalgic quality early on. I mean, I can remember being, 13 years old and thinking, the music of my parents was better than, and it's sort of an odd psychological quirk that leads you to collect old records and draw comics and things like that. And I tend to, in my more recent comics, I tend to think instead of criticizing the world as it is, I'm sort of moving more into trying to create a world as I wish it would be. And so mm-hmm. that David Boring is sort of a transition between that. And I think the things I'm sort of moving into with my work right now are more a sort of a creation of a kind of a dream world for myself, which I think is possibly caused to lock me in a room, not unlike this one, padded walls.
I found myself thinking that in a way, the way David Boring works out, it's like farce put through a cyclotron. there's a satisfying coming together, but it wouldn't be satisfying for the reader or observer of it all, but it wouldn't be satisfying for any of the characters.
Well, that was, I wanted it to have a satisfying resolution so that you could almost hear the romantic music playing as you walked out of the theater, but when you got home and thought about it, you'd think, boy, that's, the ending is that the world is going to end and he's having an incestuous affair with his cousin underwater. I guess that's happy.
That sounds great.
Could be worse.
I like stories that end like that, that sort of end with momentary happiness for the characters and sort of endless despair for the rest of us or something.
I've gotten so many questions about the last two pages of my book saying, like, well, does that mean that Jimmy Corrigan is going to be happy now? It's like, I can't answer that. And it's I find it kind of frustrating that people would even want to know that. Like, they're not, like, maybe I'm a bad writer. Maybe I should have, like, said, and yes, and so he was happy, but it's, that's not the point, That's not the point of anything,
The pleasure to me in particular of Jimmy Corrigan is that it's found a way to create of the dull repetition of life something that has become almost like a fugue. And so it has this quiet and beautiful structure that is an anatomy of boredom and loneliness, but does not itself participate in boredom and loneliness.
Well, I wanted to make it that, that's what I kind of hoped for, and that in the story itself being very mundane and sort of dry, I wanted by contrast to present it in a way that was, at least to me, seemed as beautiful as I could possibly make it. I tried to compose every page as carefully as, say, like an Edward Hopper painting is composed, where everything is exactly right in place and every color is exactly right, and if you change it just slightly, it's going to be off, because there are those moments in time where you feel like, oh, life really is worth living. And I wanted that to work against the whole narrative of the book, which is basically about inactivity and indecision and regret. So,
well, it's also in its way like a Tati film, color-coded, so that the first time I read Jimmy Corrigan, I noticed that there's a red bird. Is it a cardinal?
It's just a red bird.
It's a red.
Not good enough to draw a cardinal.
Generic red bird, but he's later supplanted by a redhead. And eventually, every time I saw a tiny speck of red in the frame, I'd look to that tiny corner longingly, knowing that this is the place of departing happiness.
You read it carefully. Gee, please.
Well, that's what's so satisfying. It seems to me that in the art I like, there's nothing irrelevant. In a novel, one finds that a thing has been felt and thought. Mm-hmm. And while at first I thought of the sequence in Spielberg's Schindler's List that follows a little girl, mm-hmm. It's this one splotch of red in a black and white movie, here I thought, how wonderful that so many kinds of visual complexity are being recorded. It's not necessary that they be registered by the reader. Things are happening in the corner of the eye, like Tati's desire to make sure that three or four gags were going on the screen at all times, and that you might miss the beginning of one or the end of another, but just have the buzzing sense of an ongoing, blooming world of anomaly.
I think that stuff also reads unconsciously. I think you see these little symbols, and you don't necessarily process it, but it's there. You're seeing it, and it's going to some part of your brain, and that's sort of the intent.
Well, that's part of the magic of comics, too, if I can use such a stupid phrase like that. But it really is. It's an illusion that once you get into it, in the best of comics, you forget you're reading them the same way you're supposed to forget you're reading. You're not supposed to pay attention to the typography of a page while you're reading it. And then you just suddenly feel like you're seeing it or you're watching it, and then those things can start to happen, which I think would be very difficult to make occur in prose.
In Jimmy Corrigan, for instance, I found that as I held the book, I had to hold it closer and closer to my face to see little things in it. And as I did, what I was doing was becoming like Alice, getting smaller and smaller and entering its world, so that my subjectivity, as I made my way through its labyrinth, sometimes scary and sometimes within human proportion, matched the subjectivity of the hero, who's always getting bigger and smaller himself.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that sounds good.
But perspective seems to be something that you're thinking a lot about as you work through the framing of this book.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems, I think, in comics. That maybe it's just I have my own mental block against it or something, but there's something about the reader looking into a scene that can really block an empathy on the part of the reader with what is actually going on, or prevents the sort of free travel that one has in literary fiction or prose or whatever, where you can travel from sentence to sentence through people's minds, through time and space, around and above. And in comics, it's much more complicated than that. And I mean, I think Dan has done the same thing, but he's done it in a completely different way, and it's more rooted in metaphor or something. And
could you describe that, Dan?
Well, I mean, you know, there's obvious examples of, you know, David Boring is sort of an unreliable narrator. You see him, or you hear his inner thoughts throughout the whole thing. He's narrating it, and at times you see that his thoughts exactly match what he's seeing, and then at times you see he's completely deluded and he's seeing it as he wishes he could see it. And I tried to draw the whole book with this sort of a starkness to it that sort of did not encourage empathy with any of the characters, to try to sort of treat it in a very cold way, as though we're sort of, you know, looking at the microbes in the petri dish or whatever, and so that his narrative thread, his sort of verbal thread, is sort of weaving through the images, and it's sort of emerging at times in harmony with the images, and then it's diverting from those images,
which is what completely yanks you out of the mindset of, and I don't mean to interrupt you, but of staring into a comic page, because you immediately trust everything you see in a comic book as this is what happened, this is how it happened, and as soon as you contradict that, then the reader's thrown off. And that's, I think you're probably the only artist who's even used that as a device, and it's like one of the the most important devices, I think, in the book.
So. Well, and one of the standard ways of doing comics, especially in the 50s or so, like the old EC comics, was they would describe, you know, a man walks into a theater with a fedora and a gun and he shoots everybody in the theater. And then you see a drawing of a man with a fedora with a gun shooting everybody in the theater. And it has this weird sort of, you know, you learn to not read the captions, basically. But when you do read them, it has this effect of sort of doubling everything and really sort of bludgeoning you with this intensity of, you know, we really want you to believe there is a man with a fedora. And even as a kid reading those, I always thought, well, I wish they'd either A, take out the captions, or B, do something with them.
You don't need to be told the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The culture may want, because it's grown up on advertising, to see and hear the same thing over and over and over right. again within a 3-minute period. But that's not the way the mind works.
No. And the mind doesn't need much to go on. I mean, the slightest inflection uh-huh. is very clear to even the most unsophisticated audience. You look in movies and you see the tiniest things in editing sends messages that any audience can pick up immediately. You know, just holding the camera on someone for a millisecond longer implies that they love the person they're looking at in the next frame. I mean, you know, Hitchcock, of course, goes into that.
That happens in real
depth.
Life, too.
Yeah.
Well, I think what Chip has done for book design, too, is to take the, for lack of a less stupid word, the tension between the word and the image and to really play them against each other.
When I was in, I was studying design in school, they didn't give us a whole lot of dogma, which is what I really liked, but one thing that our teacher really impounded on us, which is getting back to what he was saying with the EC comic, is very simple. You either have a picture of an apple or you have the word apple, but you don't have both of them together. You know, have a picture of an apple and have the word divorce. I don't know. You know, put those together and see what happens. What does that mean?
These two books, David Boring by Daniel Klaus and Jimmy Corrigan by Chris Ware, seem to me to invent whole reigns of narration that haven't been explored before, really, in fiction, in movies. I guess De Palma, when he used to insert those fake dream sequences or those things that would turn out to be dream sequences afterwards, was moving in that direction. But this really is playing with the whole funhouse of the mind and memory and storytelling and bringing this whole wider range of possibility. Now, I know you guys work more in image than in language, but do you think about that stuff?
Sure.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think we both are aware of it and limit it and bring it out in certain regard. I mean, like in my story, I tried to tell almost all of the contemporary parts of the story completely in the dumb comic form, which is how I think of it, which is a picture with a character talking. And in order to, I tried to use as little narration as possible, simply a word like and or an hour later or something.
Thus.
And, yeah. Thus. But in all of the sequences that were set 100 years or so before, 90 years before, were told through narration or memory, and so included in that were all of the conceits and lies that one tells oneself, and then I started to let that leak into the pictures as well. And it's actually a much more rich and complicated way of telling a story, I think, but I wanted to keep the modern sequences flat and dull for that reason, so... And I think in comics too, it's that pictures in comics aren't illustrations. They aren't drawings that are meant to be scrutinized or viewed as beautiful images or beautiful paintings. They're just simple, dumb. I don't know. Dan and I are always making jokes about this and for these, you know, intellectual words or ideograms or something. But it's a form of picture writing that you're reading and seeing simultaneously, but the fact is that you're reading it and that it's standing in for something, and it creates this false theater before your eyes where things it shouldn't illustrate what happens, it should happen on the page. A character should look like they're moving around on the page, and that's the real strength of it, I think. And you can stop that, start it, slow it down, go backwards with it, and use it in any number of different ways that I don't think I've even found out yet. So,
what amazes me here is that two books, books of pictures, in the form that people like to think of as degraded, or used to think of as degraded, are exploring, without really tipping their hand, some of the most unusual and complicated original ways of rendering a story and of considering what a story in fact is. And what's great about this is that I hope that people who think, oh, simple comic books, will open these and be flooded with the excitement of a world that you can't anticipate before you encounter it.
Well, one would hope, yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, the great thing we have going for us as cartoonists is that people do still feel this sort of familiarity with comics, and they, you know, they grow up reading the Sunday funnies and looking at coloring books and looking at animated cartoons, which Chris and I are constantly complaining that they have absolutely nothing to do with comics except they're drawn as simple cartoonish illustrations. But people feel this sort of comfort, you know, oh, Yogi Bear, and you know, it's not a big leap for them to see Jimmy Corrigan, even though it has nothing to do with it, but they still feel comfort in this little four-color world that's delineated in this way, and they can enter it sort of painlessly, and then once they're there, we hope we've got them. We can torture them for several hours.
It was especially fun to introduce people at Pantheon to this work, because they would look at Chris's comics and say, oh, that's so cute. Yeah. Oh, that's so sweet. Then they'd open them up and start to read.
Crying.
Oh, my. Then they'd come back the next day and, oh, my God, I read that last night. Oh, that was so devastating. Is he okay?
Oh, that's always the thing. They want to worry about the writer instead of experiencing the work.
Well, yeah. Natural impulse, like, yeah.
I know it all the time. I want to thank you. All my guests have been Daniel Klaus, the author of David Boring from Pantheon, Chris Ware, the author of Jimmy Corrigan, The Smartest Kid on Earth, from Pantheon, and their co-editor, Chip Kidd, who has shepherded the books through the rather difficult process of bringing difficult work to a simple world. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Mario Diaz. Special production assistance from Alan Howard with J.C. Swadek. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with a book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.